will be alerting to a counterintelligence service. Low-cost mobile telephones, available in many countries, offer opportunities for anonymous communication. If the mobile phones are purchased for cash at randomly selected retail locations, such as convenience and discount stores, there is no linkage to the user, and calls made on phones with preloaded minutes cannot be traced. If the phone is discarded after one-time use, any link with the user is destroyed. Prepaid phone cards, first introduced in the United States in the early 1980s, have grown in popularity as a cost-saving convenience for students, travelers, and spies. Telecard companies began to flourish after telephone company deregulation, when advances in satellite and communications technology created excess system capacities. Rather than allowing their global telecom systems to remain idle, the large carriers sold hundreds of millions of minutes of system usage to telecard companies for fractions of a cent per minute. Telecard companies resell these minutes, priced at pennies a minute, on phone cards at gas stations, airports, convenience stores, and chain stores in countries around the globe. Each prepaid phone card contains a concealed PIN number and allows the user to call at no additional charge to numbers within authorized countries up to the amount of minutes designated on the card. Phone cards provide travelers with an inexpensive means of calling home, but for illicit romances, criminals, and spies, they eliminate records of the calls and provide complete anonymity. If a phone card is purchased for cash at a location not under the control of the host counterintelligence service, any call made using the card is anonymous and untraceable. Cuban agent Ana Belén Montes used phone cards and digital pagers as part of a COVCOM system for contact with her handler at the Cuban mission to the United Nations in New York. To contact Montes, the handler would go to a remote public payphone in New York City and use a prepaid phone card to dial the number of a digital pager she carried and transmit his message using a 3-digit number code. Montes had also been instructed to anonymously purchase a prepaid phone card and proceed to a remote public payphone in Washington, D.C. She was to enter the phone card's 800 number, touchtone the card's unique PIN number, and dial a telephone number linked to a digital pager carried by the Cuban intelligence officer posing as a diplomat at the United Nations. With the connection made, Montes would enter a 3-digit code to communicate secretly with her handler. Though the CUIS system provided anonymity to the users and the calls were untraceable, her pattern of activity was alerting to FBI surveillance after she came under suspicion. Montes was known to carry a mobile phone, so there was no legitimate reason for her to seek out a remote payphone to make a call after receiving a pager message. In this instance, the COVCOM system was technically successful, but failed to mask the existence of the communication to well-trained counterintelligence officers. Advancements in personal digital assistants, PDAs, in the late 1990s made it easier for information to be transmitted using SHRAC techniques. FBI Special Agent Robert Hansen, who retired from his role as a Russian spy when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, reactivated himself in 1999 and wanted to incorporate the latest digital technology for his secret communications. In a message to his handlers dated June 8, 2000, Hansen wrote, "One of the commercial products currently available is the Palm 7 organizer. I have a Palm 3, which is actually a fairly capable computer. The 7 version comes with wireless internet capability built in. It can allow the rapid transmission of encrypted messages, which if used on an infrequent basis, could be quite effective in preventing confusions if the existence of the accounts could be appropriately hidden, as well as the existence of the devices themselves. Such a device might even serve for rapid transmittal of substantial material in digital form." Advances in microelectronics and personal computers added to the capabilities and effectiveness of constantly improving COVCOM systems. Former MI6 officer Richard Tomlinson described a system known as Garfield the Cat, issued only to long-term and highly trusted British agents in countries such as Russia and South Africa. The agent writes a message on a laptop computer, then downloads it into the SHRAC transmitter, a small box about the size of a cigarette pack. The receiver is usually mounted in the British Embassy and continually sends out a low-power interrogation signal. When the agent is close enough, in his car or on foot, his transmitter is triggered and sends the message in a high-speed burst of VHF. The transmitter is disguised as an innocent object. For many years, Garfield stuffed animals were popular, as their suction feet allowed the agent to stick the transmitter on the side window of his car, giving an extra car signal as he drove past the embassy. In 2006, a spokesman for Russia's Federal Counterintelligence Service announced on Moscow television that British diplomats had been photographed servicing an electronic dead letter box hidden inside a fake hollowed-out rock in a city park. A hidden video camera planted by the FSB photographed two men identified as British diplomats as they attempted to activate their non-working rock. Concealed inside the rock were a receiver, transmitter, computer, and power supply designed for secret communication with a Russian agent. To activate it, the agent would secretly input his reports using only the keypad of a standard cell phone or other personal electronic device. Once prepared, the PED was placed in a transmit mode by using a combination of keystrokes known only to the agent. The PED would then continuously send out a low-power signal, similar to Bluetooth technology, until it was within the range of the rock. Then, without requiring any additional actions by the agent who was carrying the PED concealed inside his coat pocket, the device would receive a confirming signal from the rock and transmit its encrypted information in a quick burst of energy. If the rock contained any stored messages for the agent, they would automatically be transmitted to his concealed PED. The clever device updated the Schreck technology developed by OTS more than a quarter century earlier and made it safer. The agent's PED appeared unaltered apart from an undetectable software modification. Even the low-power transmission to and from the PED had a range of only 30 feet, which made it difficult to detect. The agent's handlers transmitted and received stored messages from the rock in a manner identical to that used by the agent. Once the rock had been discovered by the FSB, it was intentionally disabled to lure its caretakers, in this instance MI6 officers posted to Moscow as embassy staff members, to the rock to make repairs. The FSB announced that following the discovery of the first rock, they also found a second rock concealed in a mound of snow at another location. Whether using OWVL radio in World War II, scrambled Schreck during the Cold War, or Internet steganography for the war against terrorism, every clandestine COVCOM system must meet five objectives. Break the transaction so if one end of the communication is discovered, it should not provide a link to compromise the person at the other end. The message content is secondary to the security of the agent. Use the best available physical or electronic hiding techniques. COVCOM must always incorporate the most advanced technologies available at the time. Once a COVCOM system has been identified, the vulnerability of other agents being operated by the same intelligence service increases. The 1996 COVCOM techniques employed by Cuban agent Gerardo Hernandez and his Miami-based WASP network proved helpful in recognizing similar tradecraft employed by Ana Belén Montes in 2001. Employ strong encryption and ciphers to make the message so difficult to crack that, even if discovered, its contents are protected. Remain portable with capability to communicate with a variety of hardware platforms. Be backwards and forwards compatible, with sufficient flexibility to allow future security improvements to be incorporated while still allowing older communications to be read. Jim Gosler concludes his essay, The Digital Dimension, in Transforming U.S. Intelligence, with words of reality, caution, and optimism. In Gosler's view, the reality facing the CIA is that intelligence services, allies and adversaries alike, have incorporated the digital dimension into their offensive and defensive operations. The caution for CIA operations is that defending against the sophisticated use of digital technology presents previously unknown and unaddressed gaps in its capabilities. The optimism is that 21st century human and technical operations, when linked and mutually supportive, will solve problems otherwise intractable in either domain. A basis for such optimism can be seen in the history of OTS. The future effectiveness of American intelligence will depend on how well the lessons of that history are applied. Epilogue: An Uncommon Service, by Robert Wallace. For 50 years, OTS officers stood ready to serve whenever and wherever America's leaders needed their talents. President George W. Bush, Letter to CIA, August 24, 2001. John McMahon had more connections to OTS than any other senior CIA officer. In May 1973, he became its first director when TSD was moved from the Directorate of Operations to the Directorate of Science and Technology and renamed. McMahon relied on OTS for technical support as Deputy Director for Operations, 1978 to 1981, and directed the CIA's technical programs as the Deputy Director of Central Intelligence, 1981 to 1985. He was an informal advisor to OTS directors after leaving government service and served as the honorary chairman of the 50th Anniversary Committee. On September 7, 2001, McMahon addressed an audience of 500 retired and active CIA officers who gathered to celebrate OTS's golden anniversary in the agency's auditorium. Technical services are driven not just by advances in technology, but more importantly, by the innovation of the technical officers who capture the potential of technology and bring it to application in operation, McMahon observed. Turning to how the CIA's operations officers used spy gear, McMahon said he detected a recurring 50-year pattern. Build it, and they will try it. Make it work, and they will come back. McMahon's remarks encompassed a half-century of OTS contributions to clandestine operations. OTS forgers had fabricated documents for agents to infiltrate the Soviet Union in the early 1950s and created alias cyber identities for case officers 5 decades later. OTS chemists made undetectable secret inks when writing was a primary means for clandestine communications, and its electrical engineers seized technology to develop radios whose millisecond transmissions were almost impossible to intercept. OTS psychologists evaluated the motivation and courage of a would-be agent. Mechanical engineers hid audio bugs in lamps to capture private conversations. These were the scientists, engineers, and craftsmen who built America's gadgets and disguises. They bugged embassies, trained saboteurs, and tracked down terrorists. When an operation went awry, they sat in foreign jails. When others were held hostage, they came to help. From its beginning, OTS understood that supporting operations was its mission. Whether the operational requirement needed research, development, engineering, production, training, or deployment, OTS acted, driven by a philosophy of unapologetic responsiveness to national security needs. No constraints were placed on the imagination of the agency's technical wizards. If we can think it, we can do it. Our boundaries are the limits of what we can imagine, and sometimes the laws of physics, said a tech who devoted 35 years to OTS. This philosophy of limitless possibility produced an organization of a few thousand technical specialists who gave U.S. intelligence its decisive Cold War technical advantage and continue to equip the CIA for its battle against terrorism. If not attempted during rush hour, the 8-mile drive from CIA headquarters in Langley to Capitol Hill takes no more than 15 minutes. The route, south along the George Washington Parkway, across Memorial Bridge and down Constitution Avenue, provides a tourist's view of famed landmarks: the Lincoln Memorial, the Vietnam Memorial, the White House, the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial, and finally, the Capitol Dome. On such trips, I found myself moved by the familiar yet singular symbolism of these monuments to liberty. I passed those landmarks scores of times as director of OTS to meet with the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Responsible for congressional oversight of the CIA, these committees needed to know the requirements and problems of agency components and I was determined that they hear about them firsthand from OTS. The conversations, held in secure rooms in the Hart Senate building or the south wing of the Capitol, were frank, detailed, and not broadcast by C-SPAN or leaked to the newspapers. Speaking with members of Congress and their staff, I defended and advocated funding for OTS programs. In some years, I sought survival money for critical capabilities, and under other circumstances, I made the case for resources to launch programs for new capabilities. I always carried OTS toys to show the latest innovations of the office. These devices were usually small enough to put in my coat pocket and briefcase, yet impressive in illustrating the ingenuity and skill of OTS engineers, craftsmen, and contractors. The toys might include dead drops or concealments, tiny batteries, prototypes of advanced beacons, or covert communication systems. Customarily, the devices were passed among the committee members and their staffs, and each person wanted to examine the component or the gadget up close. Invariably, the committees were amazed at the small size of the devices and that otherwise ordinary objects had been modified to perform extraordinary clandestine functions. It was not difficult to imagine how Stanley Lovell and other OTS directors similarly captivated presidents, senators, or congressmen with examples of ingenious devices of their era. William Donovan, it was reported, was so proud of the silenced high-standard pistol produced by Lovell that he demonstrated it for President Roosevelt by firing it into a sandbag in the Oval Office while the president talked on the phone. As remarkable as the technological progress of spy gear since World War II and the days of Penkovsky may seem, the impact of digital and materials technology on clandestine operations during my 7 years at OTS was revolutionary. Paralleling the technology change was a dramatic shift in the intelligence battlefield from the dominance of a Soviet strategic threat to a demand for tactical intelligence to defeat terrorist plots and disable their weapons. In responding to post-Cold War operational requirements, OTS had adopted digital technologies that radically changed the size and capability of our equipment. By 2001, the seemingly limitless ingenuity of OTS and its contractors made many of the toys I had taken to committee briefings in 1996 technological antiques. On my final trip to Congress as director of OTS in the summer of 2002, I displayed our most advanced tracking and communications equipment. My purpose was to talk about OTS's substantial role in operations against terrorism and Al-Qaeda. As the committee members and staff looked over the devices, I pulled from my pocket another item that I believed spoke eloquently to the future of clandestine technical support. I fear that my successor OTS directors may no longer be able to show you so many neat gadgets and bugs, I said, as I held up a compact disc purchased at Radio Shack that morning. I expect this is the spy gear you will be seeing in the future because the most significant espionage equipment will be embedded in software. This disc is spy gear, but it does not have much of a gee whiz factor. It appears so everyday and common that its importance can be easily overlooked. We will need to learn to communicate to you and the American public that 21st century digital spy gadgets are as necessary as Buster and the T-100 camera were for their time. 6 years later, that compact disc is already obsolete. This concludes Spycraft.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.